A lost gospel has been found. The National Geographic Society recently revealed the long-lost Gospel of Judas with lots of fanfare. They've had special on TV. The guests have been on the talk programs talking about the Gospel of Judas. The National Geographic even has its own special website to talk about the process of bringing this Gospel of Judas to the American public, to the world for that matter, and talking about what it's about. It's a different gospel. In this gospel, everything is flip-flopped. The 11 disciples, apart from Judas, are all the ones who really don't understand very much. It's only Judas who seems really to get the message that Jesus is trying to teach. In fact, in this gospel, Judas is not really pictured as a traitor or as a betrayer at all. In fact, he is a willing collaborator with Jesus who encourages him and applauds his turning Jesus over to the Roman authorities for purposes that we'll talk a little bit later on. The scholastic world is just abuzz about this discovery of the lost gospel. In fact, the executive vice president of the National Geographic Society, and may I suggest that you pay attention to who this guy is? He's one of the ones who really wants people interested in this. And this is what he says about it. He says, it's the most significant ancient non-biblical text found in the past 60 years. But others are saying pretty much the same thing, those who are not associated even with the National Geographic Society. Some of them are saying this document's going to set off years of study and debate about the historical Jesus. This is a document that sheds new light on the historical relationship between Jesus and Judas. We only thought we understood the connection between Jesus and Judas and what Judas did. This gospel just throws all that to the side and brings new light to our understanding. Listen to what Marvin Meyer, who is a professor of religion in California, says at a university. He says, we'll be talking about this gospel for generations to come. That is, incidentally, no indication of the length of the sermon this evening. Because I'm going to talk just briefly about the doctrine or the gospel of Judas, and I can almost guarantee you it'll be the last that you'll hear from this pulpit in any concerted way about the gospel of Judas. But I thought it was interesting that twice now comments have been made in the service already about the fact that everybody's talking about this discovery. Maybe you've heard people talking at work or maybe at school or among your friends. Somebody has said something about the gospel of Judas. And there's an opportunity there for us. What is this gospel's relationship to the New Testament? Well, you're never going to find it in the New King James Version. And I don't think you're going to have to paste in the Gospel of Judas, perhaps at the end of your New Testament, in whatever Bible it is that you customarily use. But that's the impression that's being left by all of the scholastic talk. Oh, we've got new truth. This is a lost gospel that now has been discovered and will be of inestimable value to us in learning about Judas and about Jesus. So this evening, what I'd like to do is talk to you a little bit about the Gospel of Judas. I want to begin by telling you some things about this document that you may not have heard. Talk to you a little bit about the process by which it was discovered. And I want to talk to you about where it came from. We know something about that more than some people are letting on. And then finally, I want to suggest to you that this really is an opportunity for evangelism. It's an opportunity for us to talk to friends and neighbors about something that they're talking about now. They're talking about God's Word. This is a wonderful opportunity for us to make a contrast between the Gospel of Judas and the canonical Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Well, let's talk a little bit about this lost Gospel, the Gospel of Jesus or Judas. And just in general, you saw on the last chart there was a manuscript there, and it was in pieces, all kinds of little fragments. The Gospel of Judas actually is part of what's known as a codex. A codex is just a word that refers to an ancient book Often books, obviously in the ancient times, were in scrolls, but a codex was actually a book where you'd have individual leaves of papyrus or parchment or vellum, and they would be bound together between covers. This codex is 66 pages long. It is bound in leather. It is papyrus. It was found in Egypt. It is dated, that is, the codex. I'm going to try to pronounce this. I really would like to not say this word any more than I have to. Chakos. And it has been, if you look at the word, it's spelled T-C-H-A-C-O-S. And we're not saying that word anymore tonight if we can avoid it. But anyway, it is named after an antiquities dealer who was instrumental in getting it to the National Geographic Society. The codex, this book, contains other documents. Only 26 of the pages actually belong to the Gospel of Judas. Other documents that are also included in this codex are the first apocalypse of James, the letter of Peter to Philip, and then a portion of another book that is sometimes called the Book of Strangers or the Book of Ologenes, which is essentially the translation of strangers. The Gospel of Judas is a copy of an earlier Greek gospel. It's a copy in the Coptic language. It has been verified by apparently a number of experts. There doesn't seem to be any question about whether this is really a legitimate manuscript find, whether it is legitimately from the second, or I should say the third or fourth centuries. That seems clearly to be the case. And in fact, there's something interesting about this gospel. Back in 180 AD, I know you don't remember this, but back in 180, one of the church fathers by the name of Irenaeus, or Irenaeus as he's sometimes called, wrote in writing against Gnostics, he mentioned a document called the Gospel of Judas. We just didn't have a copy of it. It's very likely that Irenaeus was talking about the very document, or at least that gospel that we have a copy of in this particular codex. Now, the gospel is named the Gospel of Judas, but clearly if it was dated even into the second century, you know enough about the Bible to know that it wasn't written by Judas. It was written long after Judas had died, and in fact should be dated after the death of the other apostles as well. This document, this codex, I should say, was actually discovered in Egypt in the 1970s. I'm amused that the National Geographic Society is hawking this, along with others, as this recent discovery. It's been around for 36 years. But what happened was, it kind of circulated among a number of antiquities dealers in Egypt at first, where it was found, and then later on in Europe, and finally came to the United States. But the people who could have done something with it didn't have the money to pay what the antiquities dealers were asking. And so for 16 years, this manuscript essentially rotted in a safe deposit box in a bank in Long Island, New York. So much for the love of antiquities. Finally, however, it was purchased back in the year 2000 by a woman by the name of Frida Nussberger Chakos, hence the name. And she, in turn, having unsuccessfully tried to sell it and unable to do so, she turned it over to the Maecenas Foundation, which allowed the National Geographic Society to reconstruct the document, the codex, and also to translate it. That process took 5 years. And the reason was, this document has been described, this manuscript has been described as being in the worst condition of any ancient manuscript. That doesn't make for a lot of confidence in the results that they've gotten. It is described as being those 13 pages on both sides, 26 pages, leaves of the Gospel of Judas, as being in over 1,000 fragments. I'm going to show you a few quotes from the Gospel of Judas a little bit later on. And what you'll notice is that there are whole lines, series of lines, that are just missing. And, of course, people have reconstructed this so that everything's in the right order. Anyway, that took 5 years. And so it's a very poorly preserved manuscript. That, of course, detracts from its value. Now, of course, the most interesting feature about this gospel is that it presents a picture about Judas that we're not used to hearing. Incidentally, there were some writers back in ancient times who did write about the possibility of a good Judas, not the Judas that we know from scriptures. But here are some of the things that are said about Judas, and I've suggested some of them already. He's the only one, according to this gospel, who really understood what Jesus was trying to teach. The other 11 were clueless, even more so than the canonical gospels seem to present them at times. In the gospel that bears his name, Judas is not excited about betraying the Lord. In fact, he is pained at the fact, by the fact that Jesus encourages him to do that. And Jesus says to Judas in this gospel that Judas would exceed all of them, speaking of not just the other 11, but all of the Lord's disciples, for you will sacrifice the man that clothes me. You'll be the one responsible for me being able to leave this human body behind. You're going to betray me to the Roman authorities, they'll crucify me, and I'm better off. And so, Judas, you're doing me a favor, is basically the idea behind all of that. Here is a quotation from the Gospel of Judas. This is part of an English translation that you can download, if you'd like, from the National Geographic Society's website. And here's what Jesus says, or I should say, Judas asked Jesus, "Look, what will those who have been baptized in your name do?" And Jesus says, "Truly I say to you, this baptism, missing, my name, about 9 lines, missing, to me, truly I say to you, Judas, those who offer sacrifices to Sackless, God, 3 lines, missing, everything that is evil." Can you make any sense out of that? Me either. But here's what's said at the end of that quotation. "But you will exceed all of them, for you will sacrifice the man that clothes me." So Judas comes across as being the helper and really the most favored disciple of Jesus rather than any of the other disciples. In order to really understand what this gospel's significance is, we need to understand something about a group of individuals who were known as Gnostics. And many of you have already heard of this group. In fact, you may have even read about them in connection with the Gospel of Judas. The Gospel of Judas is a product of a sect among the Gnostics. The Gnostics were divided in several groups. They didn't all believe exactly the same thing. And one of those sects is actually responsible for the production of this Gospel of Judas. It's interesting to me that although the press hype is clearly designed to give the impression that the Gospel of Judas is a unique discovery, a lost gospel, the fact of the matter is there were other Gnostic gospels. Some of you may even have heard of the Gospel of Mary, Gospel of Mary Magdalene, or the Gospel of Philip, the Gospel of Thomas, and the Gospel of Truth. There were lots of Gospels that were written in early years, that is, in the first few centuries. All of these Gospels were Gnostic Gospels, just like the Gospel of Judas is a Gnostic Gospel. In 1945, there was a discovery made in Egypt in a town called Nag Hammadi, a library that had been hidden. A library of Gnostic materials, Gnostic documents. There were 13 codices in total, and a bunch of Gnostic works that had been hidden by monks in a nearby monastery. Those were forbidden documents. In fact, prior to that discovery in 1945, which has really enlarged our knowledge about Gnosticism, the only thing we really knew about Gnosticism was from the people who were writing against it. But with Nag Hammadi, we now had their documents, and we could read firsthand what the Gnostics really believed. There's a point to all of this, and I'm coming to it. Be patient with me. If we were to summarize just very quickly the Gnostic beliefs, and that's not as easy as it might seem because they didn't all agree on everything, but there were some fundamental ideas peculiar to Gnosticism in general. Gnosticism was a belief system. It wasn't just one belief, but it was a whole way of looking at the redemptive scheme and, of course, man and God. And this belief system emphasized secret knowledge, and thus the name derived from the Greek word gnosis. To know these secret things was how you accomplished or were able to achieve salvation. And so only the people who were in the know, who had the special knowledge, could be saved. Gnosticism essentially represents an attempt to assimilate Christian ideas or ideas that were peculiar to Christianity into Hellenistic philosophies. And it's some of it's a little bit bizarre, but there are some interesting things about the Gnostics that probably ought to say something about. The Gnostics did not understand our world and even heaven itself the way that Christians do, with a God, one God who's a creator and a world that he's created, a God who is both the God of the Old Testament and a God of the New Testament. But instead, the Gnostics saw a lot of what they called immortals or ions, and they were in different levels. And in fact, the God of the Old Testament was the lowest level God. He was a God who was apparently somewhat arrogant, who thought he was the only God. The fact of the matter was, according to the Gnostics, he was only the bottom of the ladder. And so there was a Logos, there was a higher God who comes to earth to help humans who can understand this special knowledge about immortals or about these luminaries, as they're sometimes also called, to get around this creator God of the Old Testament and thus be saved. Gnostics believed that all physical materials were evil. Everything created by this God that the Israelites called Yahweh in the Old Testament, or Jehovah, all of that stuff was evil. And since their bodies, our bodies, are made of dust, of physical materials, the body was perceived to be evil. And a lot of Gnostics, in fact, most of them, tended to favor ascetic practices. They denied their bodies even those things that were necessary in order really to survive or to prosper well. Some Gnostics, however, went a different direction. In fact, the opposite direction. They believe that since the body's evil, you're not going to save the body, you save the spirit. So it's really irrelevant what the body does. If you'll notice in the general epistles of John, and particularly 1 John, John makes some rather telling comments in chapter 3. John wrote toward the end of the first century when Gnosticism was starting to get a running start among some Christians. It didn't really become a widespread and influential belief system until the second and third centuries. By the fourth century, it's being stamped out and pretty much put to bed as a heresy. But in the end of the first century and into the second century, Gnosticism is really starting to get on the roll. And John writes about the fact that the ones who are righteous are the ones who practice righteousness. And it doesn't take a lot for you to figure out that John was writing to people who may have been hearing that it doesn't make any difference what the body does. As long as the spirit belongs to God, the body can go ahead and sin, and you can still be righteous. The body's evil anyway. It's only the spirit that we need to be concerned about. That's not New Testament doctrine. And John seems to be writing against that particular idea, even in 1 John in chapter 3. Now, I said earlier that the Gospel of Judas is a Gnostic Gospel. And the reason I said that is that the fingerprints of Gnosticism are all over this Gospel. When the library at Nag Hammadi was found, we got a chance to read Gnostic materials and read some of the things that they talked about. And lo and behold, some of those same ideas, some of the same words, are in the Gospel of Judas also. For instance, in the Gospel of Judas, Jesus is mocking his disciples on one occasion because they're praying to their God. I'm going to run these past you in just a little bit. I'll show you some of the quotations. But Jesus is clearly ridiculing his own disciples. And they become angry at him because he doesn't confess to being the son of the God that they are worshiping. I know that sounds awful twisted. That's the Gospel of Judas. But see, there's a difference between the real God and that God that the disciples were praying to, that God of the Old Testament. And so Jesus' disciples supposedly become angry and they begin to blaspheme him according to the Gospel of Judas. Secondly, in the Gospel of Judas, there is mentioned a person by the name of Barbello. And that name also, that person also is mentioned in a Gnostic work called the Apocryphon of John. That's one of the documents that was found at Nag Hammadi. A third fingerprint here. In the Gospel of Judas, Jesus mentions the corruptible Sophia. Sophia, a word for wisdom, who's also mentioned in many of the Gnostic versions of creation. Now here are some quotations from the Gospel of Judas. And I understand some of these quotations are just kind of, they're hard to follow. And the reason is, this manuscript was very patchy. But listen to what Jesus says. The disciples are gathered together, seated, and they're praying over their bread, and Jesus laughs at them. The disciples said to him, "Master, why are you laughing at our prayer of thanksgiving? We've done what is right." He answered and said to them, "I'm not laughing at you. You're not doing this because of your own will, but because it is through this that your God will be praised." Not God, not my God, not our God, your God. And so he makes fun, in essence, of the apostles here. They said, "Master, you are the Son of our God." Jesus said to him, "How do you know me? Truly I say to you, no generation of the people that are among you will know me." When the disciples heard this, they started getting angry and infuriated and began blaspheming against him in their hearts. So Jesus makes fun of the disciples because they're praying to their God. And they say, "But you're the Son of that God." And he says, "You don't know me." And then they're angry and they're in their thoughts blaspheming Jesus. Another quotation. Judas says to Jesus, this is the quotation in blue, "I know who you are and where you've come from. You're from the immortal realm of Barbello." Now you're not going to find that in the Bible, in the Old Testament or New Testament, but you'll find it in Gnostic documents. That name is mentioned. And then finally, the third, corruptible Sophia is mentioned also by Jesus in that gospel. And so the fingerprints of Gnosticism are on this gospel. Even further, in the Gospel of Judas, Judas sees a vision and Jesus says that he's the only one. That is, Judas is the only one who can see that. And in fact, he's the only one who can understand it. He's the top of the disciple list, not a traitor, as the canonical gospels suggest. One of the primary tenets of Gnosticism was that the way that you achieve spiritual maturity and eventually salvation was you just got into the secret knowledge. And so Jesus is telling Judas, "You're the only one who can know this." That's Gnosticism. The final thing here is a little bit hard to discuss. I'm going to skip over it. But the fact of the matter is, the fingerprints of Gnosticism are all over this gospel. It's guilty as charged. Someone says, "Well, it's a lost gospel." It's just another Gnostic gospel, and it teaches Gnostic doctrines. And Gnostic doctrines were diametrically opposed to what you and I read in our New Testaments. Well, what does all that mean to us? Well, what's the value of all this? Well, it's interesting. In a New York Times article on the 7th of April, the discovery of these ancient texts, specifically this Codex Chakos, is described as deeply troubling to some church leaders and lay believers. And that's the crux of the matter. That's what people want you to think. They want you to be concerned about the possibility that you have somehow been cheated of some truth. That what happened in fact was that some of the early church leaders got together and they said, "Listen, we like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but you know this Gospel of Thomas thing and this Gospel of Judas, we just don't like those, and so we're going to suppress those. And we're going to support these other gospels. And so what happened is the only reason you know about Matthew, Mark, Luke, and God, John rather, is because those church leaders steered you in one direction. You've been cheated. There's truth there that you ought to know about." But I want to tell you that the attitude of religious scholars toward these documents and, like, for instance, the Gospel of Thomas and other Gnostic works, really what it reveals is their low opinion of inspiration. Their misunderstanding of truth. What they really want to do is take some of the Gnostic works and some of the canonical books of the New Testament and see if they can't combine them to get the total truth about Jesus and learn about the historical Jesus. But there's a problem with that. The problem is the Gnostic Gospels are absolutely opposed to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They tell a completely different story. You can see that already, just with reference to Judas. Well, then answer this question. How can they both be true? How can they both be combined, or how can we combine them to get the truth about Jesus when we know that at least one side of the other's got to be wrong and not inspired, not divine revelation? And that's really the issue, isn't it? The National Geographic Society website suggests that the Gnostic Gospels were rejected by, quote, Orthodox churchmen in favor of the four Gospels of the New Testament. And of course, the impression that's left is that the early Christians were trying to hide certain truths from the rest of the world. Does that sound familiar to you? Things that have been suppressed about Jesus, like the fact that he was married and had children? Are you thinking Da Vinci Code? It's the same idea. That what happened is there's a whole lot of information about out there about Jesus that just was suppressed by the Roman Catholic Church. And all we need to do is just kind of explore these Gnostic Gospels and we'll know about the real Jesus. But what we end up with is a lot of blasphemy and false doctrine from worthless documents. Been a lot of fanfare made in the past over various lost books of the Bible. In fact, if you were to go back just a few years, you could find several books that have been written about the lost book of the Bible, but it's not the Gospel of Judas. It's the Gospel of Thomas. And so telling, or so strong was the support for this lost gospel, that there are scholars who believe that the Gospel of Thomas really does belong in the canon, even though it is also clearly a Gnostic gospel. Listen to what Elaine Pagels had to say. She's a professor of religion at Princeton University, so that's one strike against her already. She says, the astonishing discovery of the Gospel of Judas. Been around for 36 years. It's another Gnostic gospel. It smells just like the others, reads like the others. Along with the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, and the many other recently discovered Gospels that had remained hidden for nearly 2,000 years, is transforming our understanding of early Christianity. I'll tell you what it is doing for us. It's helping us to understand how people began to depart from the true Gospel. It's helping us to understand how people began to move away from the truth of the Gospel as presented by confirmed Gospels written by either apostles or associates of apostles. You know, something we need to remember, I guess, is that it seems many people are interested in anything that can be used to cast doubt on the New Testament documents. All you have to do is walk by the water cooler and say, you know, they discovered a gospel that just absolutely blows out Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and people will flock. You mean the gospels in the New Testament are not really true? Now, they don't know anything about those gospels because they don't ever bother to read them, but if there's something that might just push them aside, we're really interested in that. And scholars are no different in that regard. Religious scholars, I mean. Well, they're all excited about the fact that there may be some new truth. They remind me of the Athenians in Acts 17 who are always looking for some new truth. Something interesting. Something different. And that's the way this gospel is going to be characterized, is already being characterized by those who are religious scholars. Early Christians looked for evidence of inspiration in the books they accepted. They tested books for their harmony with accepted, revealed truth. The Gnostic Gospels contradict even Old Testament teaching, much less the canonical Gospels of the New Testament. Books clearly written by apostles, the ambassadors of Jesus Christ, as Paul describes himself, or by close associates of the apostles were readily accepted. And yet the Gospel of Judas was written clearly well into the second century, perhaps even later, and certainly was not written by Judas or any other apostle. And the Gospel of Judas is diametrically opposed to the story that's presented by the four canonical Gospels. Let me give you some illustrations of that. In the Gospel of Judas, there's a God who created the world. He's a lower God, and he's not really connected to Jesus. Jesus is not his son. In fact, Jesus kind of belittles that idea in the text that we saw. But in the Bible, the God of the Old Testament is a benevolent creator, not a malevolent tyrant, which is the way the Gnostics almost present the creation God of the Old Testament. And Jesus is his son, sent by the Father, instrumental in the creation. Look at passages like Genesis chapter 1, verse 31. The Gnostics believe that all matter is evil. But look at what God says in Genesis 1. God saw everything that he'd made, and indeed, what about everything? It was very good. There's nothing evil inherently about physical matter. But the Gnostics, of course, believe that. In John, the first chapter, it is asserted that the Logos, the Word, Jesus, was with God, and he was God. He was in the beginning with God, and all things were made through him, and without him nothing was made that was made. According to the Gospel of John, Jesus said, remember in John chapter 4, when the disciples went into town to get some food, came back, found Jesus talking with the Samaritan woman, and they brought food for him to eat, and Jesus says, my food is to do the will of him who sent me and to finish his work. Jesus says, I'm the Son who's been sent by the Father. I and my Father are one. Not the same person, but united in our purpose. That's not the Gospel of Judas. The Gospel of Judas affirms the existence of many gods, and yet clearly in the Bible, there is one God. James said, in James 2 and verse 19, in talking about faith, he says, you believe there's one God. You do well. Even the demons believe and tremble. Even the demons understand, apparently, what the Gnostics did not. In the Gospel of Judas, Judas is the only disciple who really understands Jesus. But in the canonical Gospels, I don't even have to tell you about the story of Judas. He's presented as a thief in John the 12th chapter. Do you remember that? Jesus is being anointed by the woman, and Judas asks the question, why was this fragrant oil not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor? And he said this, not because he cared about the poor, John records, but because he was a thief and had the money box. You know what? We're going to have to choose, aren't we? You just can't reconcile these two things. I read one scholar who said, you know, the Gospel of Judas is really not all that opposed or all that different from the canonical Gospels, if you just understand it right. You're going to have to strain a little bit, because the canonical Gospel says he's a thief and he's a betrayer. Look at this. The devil put it in the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray Jesus. It wasn't a willing collaboration with Jesus. Now, I hasten to point out that Jesus says, what you do, do quickly. Jesus understood that he was going to be the betrayer. I suspect Jesus picked Judas, but Jesus never lauded Judas for what he did. And that's what the Gospel of Judas suggests. And Judas understood that according to the Gospel of Matthew. After Jesus had been betrayed and was being tried, here comes Judas with the pieces of silver. And he comes to those with whom he has made his covenant, and he wants to return the money. Of course, they won't take it back, or don't want to take it back. And he says, I've sinned by betraying innocent blood. That's not the Gospel of Judas. In the Gospel of Judas, he is doing Jesus a favor by betraying him to the Roman authorities, who will put him to death and free him from this human body. And so in the New Testament, Judas is revealed to be a thieving, traitorous betrayer who kills himself later on account of his sin. In the Gospel of Judas, secret knowledge is exalted. But Paul warned Timothy in the New Testament not to be seduced by the knowledge or gnosis falsely so called in 1 Timothy 6 and verse 20. We're going to be studying in the adult class very soon Colossians. And in Colossians 2, Paul makes a very telling statement. He says that in Jesus are hidden all the treasures of knowledge and wisdom. Jesus is the source of wisdom, not this Gnosticism that may have even had started beginning at the end of the first century. I'm afraid that the gospel of Judas is, if it was a lost gospel, it could have stayed lost. And nobody would have been any the worse off. It's just another Gnostic gospel written long after the death of the apostles, certainly not inspired. And like other Gnostic gospels, it contradicts the gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And I'll tell you, that's an opportunity. When somebody wants to talk about the gospel of Jesus, and they're just all a bubble about all these new discoveries, the first point that I would make is, you know, that gospel of Judas really contradicts a lot of things that are in the gospels in the New Testament. You really can't believe both. They can't both be true. So one's false and one's true. What we need to do is talk about how we're going to tell the difference. That's an opportunity to open the Bible and talk about the evidence that is for the inspiration of New Testament documents. I think sometimes when something like this comes up, if we don't know too much about it, it scares us a little bit. They found another gospel. Here we thought we had all the books, 27. We thought we had, you know, the whole book that God wanted us to have. And they found another gospel. And that's exactly what the media wants you to think. That's what the liberal scholars want you to think, that what we have to do is we have to evaluate the canonical gospels in the light of this new information. A, it's not new information. And B, it contradicts what's already been confirmed and has excellent textual evidence and support, as distinguished from the Gospel of Judas in its condition, preservation, etc. We need to know about these things. No reason to fear the Gospel of Judas. It's just more of the same false doctrine that's been around for quite some time, actually. You know something interesting about the Gospel of Judas? It is not really, at least the portions that we have, if indeed we have all of it, and what has been, it's not really a discussion of the entire public ministry of Jesus Christ. When you go into the Gospels, some of the Gospels begin with the birth of Jesus Christ. Others begin with His public ministry, essentially. But they're all kind of surveying or giving us a good overview of the entire life of Jesus, including what Jesus commissioned His apostles to do in the end, following His resurrection. You don't see that in the Gospel of Judas. In fact, the Gospel of Judas will not tell you what you need to do in order to be saved. It'll not tell you the truth. Oh, it's got a lot of stuff in there about luminaries and secret knowledge and all of that. But it will not tell you what the Lord instructed His disciples to preach to every creature. That he who believes and is baptized shall be saved. And so we understand from the record in Acts as they carried out that great commission and they preached that gospel, the gospel of the Son of God, of the grace of God, as it's available to man to save them from their sins. And as we watch people respond to that gospel, as we see it in the pages of the book of Acts, and we listen to the Ethiopian eunuch confess his faith in Jesus Christ, and we hear Peter on the day of Pentecost instructing those distraught Jews about how they needed to repent and be baptized for the remission of their sins, now we understand what we need to do in order to be saved from our sins. Now that's the truth. Not a Gnostic gospel. That's the confirmed good news of the New Testament. If you need to obey that gospel, then we stand ready and willing this evening. In fact, we want to encourage you to take this opportunity now, while you have the time and the opportunity to obey the gospel, even as we stand and sing, to invite you.